Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Charlie Herman, in for Allison Stewart. On November 25th, United States Customs and Border Protection officers used tear gas on hundreds of Central American asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border between Tijuana and San Diego. This act made international headlines and prompted accusations of human rights abuses. It also led to a closer look at who makes the tear gas that was used. As Hyperallergic's Jasmine Weber reported 2 days after these events, the company that makes the tear gas canisters is owned by a vice chairman at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Since her story was published, there have been protests at the Whitney Museum, calls for the vice chairman's resignation, as well as an emerging conversation about how major art world institutions can be held accountable for where they get their funding. Well, here to explain the details of this evolving story are Hyperallergic's Jasmine Weber, an associate editor, and Rog Vartanian. He is the site's editor and chief and co-founder. Both of you, welcome to All of It.
Great. Thank you.
Rog, let me just sort of start and say, when Jasmine first came to you with this story and you saw what was actually there in it, I'm wondering, what did you think was going to happen when the story was published, and what did happen?
That's a good question. You know, when you put a story out into the world, you always have expectations and hopes. And I think we really hoped it was just going to create a little more scrutiny about who these figures are that are supporting the arts and the museum in general, because a lot of conversations are happening nowadays about where a lot of this money is coming from and the inequality that's built into the system. So, you know, we were hoping that it would address that. And honestly, it really seemed to resonate deeply.
Jasmine, when you wrote the story after the tear gas was used on the U.S.-Mexican border, you identified the manufacturer as a company called Safariland. Tell me more about it and its CEO.
So Safariland is owned by Warren Kanders, who is also one of the vice chairmen at the Whitney Museum. And so Safariland is essentially a large corporation, and within it are smaller subsidiary companies that produce different types of defense gear, including bulletproof vests, and then, of course, tear gas and less immediately dangerous level, like types of smoke bombs. And so when the news broke on Thanksgiving weekend about the tear gas being used at the border, a lot of people were saying that rather than tear gas, it was smoke bombs. And reporters on site were able to discover that both were being used.
Right. And Harag, I want to ask you, Kanders is the CEO of this company. He's a vice chairman at the Whitney. What is his connection between this company, Safariland, and art?
Well, I mean, he's a patron of the arts, but he also owns this company that is literally being involved in a lot of the issues that have been front and center in terms of the Whitney and some of its sort of social justice, you know, focused programming. So, I mean, that this tear gas we're talking about was used at Ferguson, was used at the border. It was used, you know, it's used in Gaza. It's used in so many of these flashpoints, including Standing Rock. So, you know, people are seeing it as hypocrisy on the part of an institution saying, here's, you're holding this up as these flashpoints of our culture that we should discuss. But then all of a sudden you have a vice chair on your board who's actually benefiting from this kind of these incidents.
And how, I mean, we know that many board members are there because of donations. So what is his connection to the art world? How, you know, more of that background?
Well, he did support the Warhol exhibition that's currently up. And he's, you know, he's been a collector and a patron. So, I mean, what I think part of the issue is whether he's actually exerting his ideological control. I think that's the fear, right, of these types of issues. And people are concerned, is this guy sort of finding a way to sort of insert
influence
himself?
Influence the type of exhibitions that
exactly.
are being done. But is there any sense that that is happening?
Well, I think the bigger term also is art washing. That's a term that is increasingly coming up more and more. And that means essentially doing something negative that has a negative PR spin and then using art as a way to sort of wash away that stink. You know, and I think that's increasingly what people are seeing people like Kanders doing. And I think that's the concern.
It's the worry that maybe I'm involved in businesses that some people may find distasteful, but I invest in something over here that people like. So the two, you come out at a zero-sum game sort of
thing. That's right, right.
Jasmine, how did the staff react at the Whitney, and how did the management respond?
So the staff very quickly was able to put together a letter that was supported by about 100 staff members at the Whitney, ranging from on-the-ground staff working in the galleries to the curatorial department. And so they came together to ask the Whitney administration to directly address the reporting that we had done and to address the reasons why Kanders was a member of the board and then to also reevaluate their policy for board members to basically create a system of values that the museum upholds and that the museum would like their board members to uphold and to look into where the money that they're accepting is coming from. That was one of their main asks of Adam Weinberg, who's the director of the Whitney Museum. The response on behalf of the museum, Weinberg released a statement essentially saying that as an institution, the Whitney does not have a moral obligation to vet their board members to ensure that they're upholding the same values that their exhibitions are upholding. Just last year, the Whitney held a year-long exhibition called An Incomplete History of Protest, where they looked at the different social movements that have influenced art and the different social movements that have been active at the Whitney Museum, such as a group of women pioneering for equal representation in their biennials, as well as a group called the Black Emergency Cultural Coalition campaigning for the Whitney to include more African Americans in their exhibitions. And so those were present. And then I think it's interesting that very quickly after that exhibition had closed was when this new protest has really taken these huge waves in the art world.
Are there very specific things that the activists who have sort of who are looking at this issue and want changes? What are the changes that they want? And I mean, what is resolution for them?
Yeah. So, Decolonize This Place is the group that has been most actively campaigning. And so, in the past, they've protested at the Brooklyn Museum to raise awareness about gentrification that the museum is complicit in through their use of a specific real estate company, as well as the Brooklyn Museum protesting different artifacts in their collections that have been looted from countries that were colonized. And so what they hope at the Whitney is that the museum will address the demands of their staff members, as well as institute a policy of transparency as to where their money is coming from, and one ask that they're explicitly hoping for is that rather than these responses coming in the form of PR statements and letters to attempt to appease the past, and rather than treating the situation as a PR mishap, to directly address their concerns that the museum is benefiting from money that has taken the form of this neocolonialism, in the sense of allowing state authorities and federal authorities to enact active violence on marginalized populations at Standing Rock and at the border and in Gaza.
Harag, what's interesting is talking about the Brooklyn Museum and the Whitney Museum. I mean, these are two that there seems to be a sense that they are really trying to tap into progressive ideals. Mm-hmm. And as Jasmine was just mentioning, this year-long exhibit about the incomplete history of protest. And if you look at what the exhibits at the Brooklyn Museum has been putting on, they're embodying or trying to embrace very progressive ideas. And yet here you have these activists very much targeting or talking to them or protesting them whatever verb you want to use there. Is there a connection there?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern, I think, in minority communities and particularly communities that feel marginalized, that they're sort of being used right now, meaning like, is there a real commitment or is this just window dressing as part of this wave of people trying to be woke or something? And I was at a panel just a few days ago here at the College Art Association that's taking place in New York. And one of the curators pointed out that, you know, during times of crisis, the U.S. always turns to its Native American heritage to often try to look for these sort of ideas. And I think the same happens to all marginalized groups where they feel like now that there's a crisis, people feel like now we're going to get our little window of time. But people want to see structural change. And we've been here before. Whitney had issues with representation, particularly of Black artists in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, and that felt like they were trying to put window dressing on a much deeper issue that they never resolved at the time and we have to deal with again.
These protests have continued on. There was an event at the Whitney in December, and then in January there was a town hall that was held at Cooper Union with Decolonize This Place. So where are things in terms of the interaction between activists and in this particular case, the Whitney, especially when they have a big show coming up, the Whitney Biennial, which is a big, you know, current artists who are often embracing some of these very topics that you're talking about.
I mean, you touched on it perfectly. It's the Whitney Biennial is their big PR push, right? This is what the museum has.
Well,
their
it's not
image.
Just a PR push.
Well, I mean, no, but do. I meant there. But in terms of their museum being sort of like represented in the world, this is what people know them for. So the event becomes a flashpoint, you know, generally. So I think people are just preparing the idea that there's probably going to be some events coming up and some protest actions and different things. So when I said PR, I meant it that way in terms of It's part of their image in the world. So this is definitely going to be a moment, you know, that people are bracing for to figure out what's going to happen.
Jasmine, from your reporting, do you have any sense as to some of the various different groups that are, you know, tying into this or wanting to make change, talking to the artists who could theoretically have their works at the biennial, telling them, you know, demand this or don't show your work or any sort of influence there that could be happening?
So there's an organization called Wage that is currently asking artists who are invited to participate in the biennial, asking that they demand payment for their artwork. And they're also demanding that, or they're requesting that these artists demand that the staff members of the Whitney have their demands met before they will release their artwork to be included in the biennial.
Are you getting a sense that some artists are agreeing to that and saying, hey, Whitney, no, you can't have my painting, my sculpture till you do this?
From what I know right now, I have not heard of any artists who have agreed to sort of be a part of this campaign. Wage also did say that it was going to be anonymous for artists who asked. There has been a general feeling that I am aware of based on reactions at the town hall that you mentioned, that some artists are unhappy with the double demand and are
the double
not
demand being of
being requesting payment and also requesting that the staff demands are met before they give their artwork to the biennial. Some people are not happy about that. That was more of a general sort of ambiguous statement that was being thrown around at the biennial, not anyone specifically saying, I am not happy with the way that this is set up, but this is what I would like in return. So I can't speak on what some of the solutions are.
Rog.
You know, and I think part of it is it would really benefit people to know the context that most artists are not paid to exhibit at major museums in New York. So often they're paying out of pocket for a lot of the things they need. So we're talking about the demands with Wage. Today they just released an email talking about this. Like an exhibition at the Whitney, we're talking about artists being paid $1,500 to participate. It's not a really incredible demand when you think in the scale of things. But the reality is that museums don't have these standard kind of payment schedules to figure out if you're an exhibiting at a solo show at the Whitney, yes, you do deserve $10,000 to pay for all those fees, you know, and I think part of it is they're trying to bring some sense of economic justice to this institution that pretends like or is pretending like it's really sort of woke, as they say.
Is that part of the issue here, that if the institution is embracing this and at the same time there's questions about if it's really doing it. Is that why it's getting more attention than maybe some other institutions that have taken money from organizations or individuals that progressive activists disagree with?
Well, I mean, I think the tear gas at the border issue was a huge issue. And I think emotionally, I think all of us viscerally sort of felt what was going on. So it came at a time when people were really angry as well. Also, I think that an institution like the Whitney just had a major renovation and, you know, $500 million. And the idea that artists aren't being paid and that, you know, where's this money coming from? Who is it actually serving is a bigger issue that's going on in the art world and elsewhere.
Because the Whitney's not the only one that's sort of under the microscope right now. There have been other institutions that have been criticized. Just recently, you had Nan Golden holding a protest at the Guggenheim. She's done it at other museums as well, too. And she's been protesting the Sackler family. And they are the makers of OxyContin. And the Sackler name you can find all over New York City and in a lot of different institutions. I mean, what do you make of this moment that we're in where there seems to be a much greater attention to where the money is coming from when it comes to how institutions, some of the greatest cultural institutions in New York City, operate?
I think it's a fantastic moment that people feel vested in these institutions. People wouldn't be protesting them and complaining if they didn't feel that they belong to them. Do you know that they were part of that? And I think that's the part that people often don't see. It's we've created this culture where people feel like these museums are part of their culture and part of their community. So I think it's actually a very powerful moment that we're sort of facing. And all these different issues, I mean, they're not going to stop. I think we're going to have them for quite a while.
Jasmine, I'm wondering who are some of the other groups that have, you know, come in and connected to this particular protest at the Whitney, and what are they looking at?
So one of the major groups that's been working with Decolonize This Place is the Chinatown Art Brigade, who has been around for decades, protesting the different ways that gentrification has been deeply affecting Chinatown in Manhattan. So one of their goals as major players in this collective of grassroots art activists is this idea that museums need to address their relationship to specific communities and the way that their presence in different neighborhoods and their relationship with different economic groups can deeply affect the way that different New Yorkers are able to interact with art and interact with their community. Because as if we're speaking specifically about galleries, as different galleries move into Chinatown, a lot of different restaurants and shops and homes are being displaced and pushed out and priced out. And so that's one of their biggest concerns. And they're bringing that into their relationship with these protests at the Whitney by being able to give this certain level of guidance of having worked in this field for decades.
But the Whitney has been trying very hard, I know, to be connected to the community that it's in, to the NYCHA housing that's around there, to the concerns about gentrification. I'm wondering, where is the Whitney standing on all the pressure that it's facing right now? What are they saying right now? How are they defending sort of the position that they are holding in the face of the criticism that they're getting from different groups?
So from my understanding, the Whitney's Community and Access Program has a lot of different programming in regards to disabled New Yorkers. They're one of the only museums in the city that has a reduced fare for disabled guests, as well as free fare for a care assistant who's accompanying them. And so I think that through programs like their Community and Access program, they're able to point towards genuinely good steps that they're making towards equity in the arts. And I think that, again, looking at that as a really wonderful example for other museums to be following doesn't necessarily negate the fact that someone like Candor's is a source of funds where these things are happening. And so people are upset about that disconnect. Because I do think that the work that the Whitney does goes beyond just utilizing artists of color in their exhibitions. I think it does go into genuine work that helps marginalized New Yorkers, including different tours that are targeted towards non-English speakers. And so I think that disconnect is what really disappoints people, because the Whitney is one of the museums that I have been told by different activists across the city that they feel a genuine investment in the museum. And like Krog said, people feel like these museums belong to them. They feel a genuine connection to them and a genuine investment in them. And if they didn't, they wouldn't be protesting what was happening. And so all of the good that the Whitney staff is doing and all of the good that their different curatorial and education departments are doing deserves to be spotlit, but it also deserves to be backed by moral funding that is aligned with what they're actually doing.
My guests have been Jasmine Weber, an associate editor at Hyperallergic, and Harag Vartanian. He is the site's editor-in-chief and founder. Thank you both for joining.
Thank you.
And that is our show. Thank you so much for listening to All of It. Allison Stewart will be back tomorrow. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Ursula Summer, Simon Close, Jordan Lauf, and Pilar Belendez-Deshay. Julia Fonda is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. And of course, thank you very much for joining. I'm Charlie Herman. See you next week.